life is really worth. It's an art that deserves gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right.
And good morning. KBOO Portland is what you're listening to. Portland's community radio station. Yeah, coming up in a half hour, join us for Fight the Empire, where today host Per Fogering speaks with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern on Russia, George Kennan, the CIA, and the Deep State, and more. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints, today featuring excerpts from the documentary film The Black Panthers, Vanguard of a Revolution. And at 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman speaks with Lacey M. Johnson about her memoir, The Other Side, her reconstruction of the events surrounding a harrowing act of domestic violence. But first, coming up next, it is Press Watch with news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. That's coming up right after this on KBOO.
On February 20th, from 7 p.m. until 10 p.m., Grassroot News will honor the memory, legacy, and life of Malcolm X. Join us for the music, the memory, and the deconstruction of Malcolm's political career, his split from the Nation of Islam, and the course of actions that led to his assassination 51 years ago on February 21st, 1965, as Ozzie Davis eulogized.
A prince, our own black shining prince, who didn't hesitate to die because he loved us so.
Again, on February 20th, from 7 p.m. until 10 p.m., join us as we honor the memory, life, and legacy of Malcolm X.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and examination of the news you're not supposed to know. So, Tony Scalia is dead. As he said of the Constitution, dead, dead, dead. The great Horatio at the bridge of narrow-mindedness. The great hero for white male supremacy. He's dead, and with him dies that deciding vote that would have struck down unions and their right to be paid for their services, at least, by people who have been taught to sneer at unions but benefit from their negotiations. And the environment benefits, and gay and lesbian people benefit by the absence of a man who compared gay sex to murder. Goodbye, Mr. Scalia. So glad. And I was asked to comment this week on the arsenic, cadmium, and hexavalent chromium that is spewed into an area of southeast Portland and detected in moss samples, and thereby finding its way into the press. However, this is an ongoing story covered and covered well by KBOO News. Tune in at 5 p.m. today. It's also been covered pretty well by many local sources. And so I have little to add. By and large, I don't do journalism. I do analysis and commentary. So By way of analysis and commentary, I can add some relevant details and try to put it into context. For example, there are several sources of pollution here in Portland, and they are localized to some extent, not entirely. For example, the Blue Heron paper mill that was there at Willamette Falls was constantly spewing dioxins into the Willamette River until it was shut down a few years ago, and examination of the site now finds very substantial amounts of dioxins, polychlorinated biphenyls dioxins. And the Willamette River is a horror. Dioxins like toxic metals can be bioaccumulative. But here's a snippet or two of the story as it progresses about the poisoning of the area around 22nd and Southeast Powell in Portland, Oregon. From the Portland Mercury blog in February 4th, Dirk Vanderhart wrote, "This was a big surprise. DEQ officials are stressing how caught off guard they were from the findings, saying repeatedly that it's all hands on deck as the agency tries to create maps that suggest where arsenic and cadmium might have spread and in what levels." David Monroe, DEQ's air quality manager for the Portland area, said the agency hadn't been aware of the kinds of threat posed by art glass manufacturers like Bullseye, and the findings could reverberate to other localities in the Pacific Northwest, end quote. And then that was followed by statements, well, for example, KOIN, just a few days later, saying state monitoring done 4 months ago revealed spikes in the levels of heavy metals in the area of 22nd and Pell Southeast. So they were kind of caught out on that. From Oregon Live, Rob Davis wrote, "Federal lawmakers on Friday," and this is a Friday past, "implored the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to respond to growing alarm over what they said were dangerous amounts of toxic pollution in Portland's air, as state regulators remain silent about plans to address the city's cancer-causing air pollution. Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley and Representative Earl Blumenauer asked for the EPA to intervene, calling the situation a public health emergency. The three Oregon Democrats escalated the already high-profile chorus of political leaders suddenly prodding environmental officials to take decisive action." And Davis also wrote, "Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality has moved slowly to respond to scientists' discovery of toxic pollution hotspots throughout Portland. The agency has known that some neighborhoods likely breathed dirtier air than others, but it kept that information secret for 8 months." So now we're up to 8 months. "Since it became public, the agency has avoided answering questions about what it knows." So by that way of providing relevant details and analysis, pardon me, here's some information from OSHA. "Workplace exposure to hexavalent chromium may cause the following health effects: lung cancer in workers who breathe airborne hexavalent chromium, irritation or damage to the nose, throat, and lung, the respiratory tract, if hexavalent chromium is breathed at high levels, irritation or damage to the eyes and skin if hexavalent chromium contacts these organs in high concentrations. How hexavalent chromium affects the nose, throat, and lungs is as followed. Breathing in high levels of hexavalent chromium can cause irritation to the nose and throat. Symptoms may include runny nose, sneezing, coughing, itching, and a burning sensation. Repeated or prolonged exposure can cause sores to develop in the nose and result in nose bleeds. If the damage is severe, the nasal septum develops a hole in it. Breathing small amounts of hexavalent chromium, even for long periods, does not cause respiratory tract irritation in most people. Some employees become allergic to hexavalent chromium, so that inhaling chromate compounds can cause asthma symptoms such as wheezing and shortness of breath. How hexavalent chromium affects the skin is the following. Some employees can also develop an allergic skin reaction called allergic contact dermatitis. This occurs from handling liquids or solids containing hexavalent chromium. Once someone becomes allergic, brief skin contact causes swelling and a red itchy rash that becomes crusty and thickened with prolonged exposure. Allergic contact dermatitis is long-lasting and more severe with repeated skin contact. Direct skin contact with hexavalent chromium can cause a non-allergic skin irritation. Pardon me, contact with non-intact skin can also lead to chrome ulcers. These are small, crusted skin sores with a rounded border. They heal slowly and leave scars." So you can find more about, of course, arsenic and cadmium at OSHA, and what they say applies to employees of course, applies to any human being who gets a dose of this stuff. And there's a famous saying, sola dosa facit venom, which is true in so many cases that it's a general truism. And what it means is only the dose makes the poison. But in the case of bioaccumulative things like dioxin, heavy metals, plutonium, that ain't necessarily so, because it builds up in the body. That's the meaning of the word bioaccumulative. Pardon me for using extra syllables. But that's what I'm talking about. So maybe sola dosa doesn't fetch it venom. Changing subjects now, a letter from Portland Cop Watch addressed to Representative Lou Frederick of the Oregon Legislature. Subject, no shielding officers' names. This is from Dan Handelman. And quoting the brief letter, dear Representative Frederick, please vote no on House Bill 4087 and encourage others to do so as well. It is very inappropriate to rush through a bill like this based on one incident with no time for public discussion. And speaking for myself, this is about allowing police officers, all of them, forever, to call for 90 days exclusion from the press after a shooting. Returning to the letter, such a bill would be a giant blow to accountability. While the proposed bill forces the police to go to a judge to shield the officer's name, the judge has 5 business days to decide on the matter, meaning that if there is no credible threat, the police can delay the release of the name just by filing a petition. And once again, speaking for myself, I can't imagine that were this to pass, that police would not then, just have their buddies call in something so it could be a credible threat so that they could get their names out of the press after a heinous shooting. But returning to the letter that Dan Handelman wrote, there is little doubt that officers will say there's a credible threat so long as there is a movement for police accountability in this country. We will never know the name of the next Ron Freshour if this bill passes. That's not an acceptable compromise. It eliminates transparency and accountability. Officers are well-armed, well-trained, and are only playing off public sympathy to try to get this bill passed. When they take or attempt to take a human life in the name of the state, they should not be afforded special protection. Rather, they should come under more scrutiny than ordinary civilians. And it says, please vote no on HB 4087, signed Dan Handelman. And as of last night, they had not passed it and is not signed by the governor. Perhaps it's worth contacting the governor if you're so inclined. To express your opinion on HB 4087. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Coming up at 9:30, Fight the Empire. And I believe at 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia. KBOO Portland, People's Radio. So now turning to international affairs. The threat of war is getting worse and worse. The actual war in Syria is unbelievably horrifying, severe, the largest migrant crisis, the largest band of refugee crisis since the Second World War. For 70 years, it hasn't been this bad. And this is really just a misery on a level that is hard to describe. Pardon me. And the U.S. most definitely has its finger in the pie. I would say 5 or 6 of them. And in North Korea, things are heating up badly. Most people are unaware that in 1994, President Bill Clinton came within hours of ordering events that probably would have led to all-out war on the Korean Peninsula. And when we're talking about war in Korea, we're talking about 1 million casualties at the minimum. 1 million. So this is not something to play around with. I'm not here to say good things about North Korea, although I do see that there's too much exaggeration and usage of North Korea as something to frighten the people of America with. But quoting the Yonhap, South Korean news agency, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has ordered intensified preparations for terror attacks on South Korea. That's according to a ruling party lawmaker, citing Seoul's state intelligence agency. Now, speaking for myself, ruling party right now has switched to conservatives again. And in that context, that means people who are against peaceful reunification, and 4, a very violent reunification of the Korean Peninsula. Returning to the article, the North's Reconnaissance General Bureau is preparing for such disruptive acts, including cyber attacks on the South. The representative said that after an urgent meeting between the ruling party and the government over North Korea. The Bureau is tasked with intelligence operations in foreign countries and cyber warfare. The government told lawmakers there is a possibility the North will wage terrorist attacks using poison or kidnap South Koreans. The North can inflict damage on anti-North Korean activists, defectors, and Seoul government officials. The official told reporters it could target public facilities and key infrastructure, including subways, shopping malls, and power stations. The National Intelligence Service in Korea is collecting the relevant information. South Korea has vowed to take bone-numbing, that's their phrase, bone-numbing measures against the North in response to Pyongyang's latest nuclear test and long-range rocket launch. The Seoul government said that the North seemed to time its recent provocations to come before its key party Congress slated for May, and that's going to be a big deal. Quoting Defense Minister Han Min-koo, Seoul and Washington plan to conduct the largest joint military drills ever, starting in March for about 2 months to counter any North Korean provocation. Now, I've got to depart from that text once again and say the joint military drills that have been held by South Korea and the United States have been incredibly huge. 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 soldiers. Well, get a load of this. He said the planned drills will likely involve 15,000 American soldiers, along with increased military assets. About twice the size of the exercises conducted last year, the two allies, meaning South Korea and the United States, have carried out annual joint exercises, Key Resolve and Full Eagle, since the 1990s to better deter North Korean aggression. And they write, the North claims the drills are a rehearsal for a northward invasion. A few more comments on this, that it is extremely dangerous that North Korea serves as a buffer state against the troops in the South, that the North Korean War has never been properly, I mean, the Korean War has never been properly resolved, that the North has been tempted for many years, and this was the case in 94, to deal with the problems that they have, including poverty, frankly, a lack of availability of food supplies, and their frustration at their isolation by the following: initiating a massive invasion southward. They're only 40 miles from Seoul. This would begin with a gigantic artillery barrage, the largest ever seen on Earth. They like to say that it would turn Seoul into a sea of fire. Troops would pour through tunnels, which are constantly being dug, constantly being found, constantly being discovered to be larger than anyone imagined. Many, many tunnels across the border. Pour into Seoul, million casualties. Everything gets extremely crazy, and I guess I don't need to go into just how crazy things can get since we do live in the post-nuclear world. Fortunately, not yet the post-nuclear war world, but we wouldn't be living in that case. So it's worth paying attention to what's happening in North Korea, and it's worth telling anyone who'll listen that, well, exactly how you feel about nuclear incineration. The time is 9:18. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I have here, if the thing will work, Radio Pyongyang. I think they call themselves Voice of Korea now. And although you won't be able to understand every word of this, give it a try for a few minutes and it'll give you a taste of what they are saying.
Provocative act of threatening peace of the Korean Peninsula and Northeast Asia. Some time ago, the South Korean Ministry of National Defense, slandering the Democratic People's Republic of Korea again, announced that they would make an official discussion with the United States on the deployment of THAAD. Meanwhile, the South Korean warmongers revealed their attempt to apply 4DO plan to the Key Resolve joint military exercises to be staged with the United States, which regards a preemptive nuclear attack on the DPRK as a fait accompli. It is a very dangerous provocative act of further escalating tension of the Korean Peninsula and bringing the situation around it to the brink of war. The South Korean warmongers' announcement that they would officially discuss with their U.S. master on the deployment of the THAAD under the pretext of defense is an...
She mentioned THAAD. That's a reference to the Theater High Altitude Defense Rockets. These are very large rockets with an extra dose of propellant. They're very, very fast, and they're intended to intercept not just aircraft, but ballistic missiles.
Rational insistence, which cannot work in any case. As for THAAD, it is the core equipment of the missile defense system the United States is frantically promoting to realize its ambition for world domination. The deployment of THAAD in South Korea is pursuant to the U.S. strategy aimed at threatening the DPRK and militarily containing the countries around the Korean Peninsula. It is really shameless that they describe it as defensive one. The United States is so active in its moves to deploy THAAD in a bid to hold military hegemony not only over the DPRK, but also in Northeast Asia. That is why not only South Korea, but also neighboring countries denounce that the description of THAAD as defensive one is a preposterous sophistry to placate a child, and it triggers off their alertness and indignation. The South Korean military warmongers act as a shock brigade in the dangerous U.S. moves to deploy THAAD will bring irretrievable disasters to South Korea and foment...
And they go on like that for a few minutes. You can get that by going to vok.rep.kp/cbc/english. .php, but it would be easier for you to use a search engine for Radio Pyongyang, and eventually you will encounter that. So I am saying that the situation is rather serious. In Syria right now, it's completely out of control, and the soccer blogger believes that things are about to escalate. Some of what he wrote, situation in Syria, he says, has reached a watershed moment and a dramatic escalation of the war appears imminent. He says, let's look again at how we reached this point. During the first phase of the operation, the Syrian armed forces were unable to achieve an immediate strategic success. This is rather unsurprising. It is important to remember here that during the first weeks of the operation, the Russians did not provide close air support to the Syrians. Instead, they chose to systematically degrade the entire Daesh infrastructure, including command posts, communication nodes, oil dumps, ammo dumps, supply routes, etc. He says he refers to all terrorists in Syria as Daesh, I suppose for the sake of simplicity. He writes, this is important work, but it did not have an immediate impact on the Syrian military. Then the Russians turned to two important tasks, to push back Daesh in the Latakia province and to hit the illegal oil trade between Daesh and Turkey. The first goal was needed for the protection of the Russian task force, and the second one hit the Daesh finances. Then the Russians seriously turned to providing close air support. Not only that, Russians got directly involved with the ground operation. The second phase was introduced gradually without much fanfare, but it made a big difference on the ground. The Russians and Syrians began to work closely together, and they soon honed their collaboration to a quantitatively new level, which allowed the Syrian commanders to use Russian firepower with great effectiveness. Furthermore, the Russians began providing modern equipment to the Syrians, including the T-90 tanks, modern artillery systems, counter-battery radars, night vision gear, etc. Finally, according to various Russian reports, Russian special operations teams, mostly Chechens, were also engaged in key locations, including deep in the rear of Daesh. As a result, the Syrian military, for the first time, went from achieving tactical successes to operational victories. For the first time, the Syrians began to liberate key towns of strategic importance. And speaking for myself, of course, this is the this is reflecting the Russian propaganda, in which what the Syrians are doing is liberating. A lot of people liberated to death. It's a complex situation there. But I'm just saying this is not my attitude. This is just what I'm reporting to you from a different perspective, that of The Soccer. You can find that at thesaker.is. He writes, "Finally, the Russians unleashed fantastically intense firepower on Daesh along crucial sectors of the front in northern Homs. The Russians bombed a sector for 36 hours in a row. According to the latest briefing of the Russian Defense Ministry, just between February 4th and 11th, the Russian Aviation Group and the Syrian Arab Republic performed 510 combat sorties and engaged 1,888 targets. That kind of ferocious pounding did produce the expected effect. And the Syrian military began slowly moving along the Turkish-Syrian border while at the same time threatening Daesh forces still deployed in the northern part of Aleppo." Speaking for myself once again, of course, this is an absolute mind-blowing horror, and people are running as fast as they can to anywhere, and mostly to Europe. And not everyone can do that, of course. Not everyone can, as one person did, push their grandmother in a wheelchair 1,000 miles. But people are trying to survive, and this is a great part of what the refugee crisis is about. Far from here, so we're not seeing it so much. Of course, we have our own refugee crisis caused by our own wars here in the United States, and we sneer at them and call them illegal immigrants. But returning to the text here, according to Russian sources, Daesh forces were so demoralized that they forced the local people to flee towards the Turkish border and attempted to hide inside this movement of internally displaced civilians. And he writes, this strategic Russian and Syrian victory meant that all the nations supporting Daesh, including Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and the USA, were facing a complete collapse of their efforts to overthrow Assad and break up Syria and turn part of it into a jihadistan. The Americans could not admit this, of course. As for the Saudis, their threats to invade Syria were rather laughable, which left the main role to Erdogan, who is more than happy to provide the West with yet another maniacal ally, willing to act in a completely irresponsible way just to deny the other side anything looking like a victory. Once again, speaking for myself, recent events, another, probably false flag bombing in Turkey and subsequent military action. He writes, Erdogan seems to be contemplating two options. The first is a ground operation into Syria aimed at restoring the supply lines of Daesh and preventing the Syrian military from controlling the border. Once again, speaking for myself, the Turks had been buying oil from Daesh. So our supposed allies were, let's see how I should reframe that. Our allies were working with the terrorists because it is, in fact, the U.S. intention to destroy, tear apart Syria using these terrorist groups of every description for the chaos. And I do believe that the end, as shown by the way the money flowed, the end intent was to create that Islamistan and sell oil from it in competition, because that's what was already happening until the Russians blew it up. He writes, according to various reports, Erdogan has 18,000 soldiers supported by aircraft, armor, and artillery poised along the border to execute such an invasion. So, it's getting towards the bottom of the hour, but the point I'm trying to make here is that the threat of war, the ongoing wars, are getting hotter. This is a situation that the American people should be reacting to and should be contacting their representatives to let them know. I'm going to presume that, like me, you think that this is madness, murderous madness, unworthy of the people of the United States. It's something that, especially since the 80s, especially since Vietnam, in fact, has been completely out of the grasp of the people in general. You don't get the truth. Not only do you get propaganda about what's going on, but you get mostly silence and so much diversion that it's hard for you to act. But this is a very serious situation that we are finding today. Right now, in the middle of February 2016, the world is starting to blow up. Syria and North Korea could be flashpoints. What are you going to do about it? You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. We're broadcasting to you via 90.7 FM from the West Hills of Portland and other frequencies in Cascadia. Stay tuned for Parafoggering come up, and stay tuned to KBOO.FM, where you can donate to us, and it's via KBOO.FM that we go out to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is A Streetcar Named Desire, showing Thursday, February 18th at 7 p.m. Winner of 5 Academy Awards and considered the first dramatic jazz score of a film, 1951's A Streetcar Named Desire remains a landmark which forced the medium into a new, raw, emotional, mature kind of expression. Again, that's A Streetcar Named Desire, Thursday, February 18th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Thank you.